Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents The Jew Store, a Family Memoir by Stella Suberman, narrated by Donna Postel. For a real bargain, while you're making a living, you should make also a life. Aaron Bronson. Prologue. If you leave the main highways and travel on one of the county roads in northwestern Tennessee, which is what I did in August of 1995, you will see endless cotton fields. I had last seen the cotton fields of Tennessee in 1933, the year my family left the South. Then the fields were small, family-owned, bounded by fences or hedgerows. Nowadays they stretch out with no lines of demarcation and have the look of big business. It is, however, still a quiet place, a rural land. I was born there, in the small town I am calling Concordia. I left the highway out of Nashville and got on to County Road 431 because of a sentimental wish to travel the same road that my parents, my brother Joey, then 7, and my sister Miriam, 5, had traveled by horse-drawn wagon in 1920, 2 years before I was born. Although County Road 431 was then a clay road meandering along, it made its way, as now, west through Weakley County and into the county I have named Banyan, of which Concordia is the county seat. Until this trip, I had not been back. A Buddhist text tells us that the elephant is the wisest of all the animals, the only one who remembers his former lives, and he remains motionless for long periods of time, meditating thereon. This may be fine for the elephant, but Concordia is one of those towns that has been steadily losing population, and I am a woman of more than a certain age. By 1995, I was feeling an urgency to forego meditating and take a look at the site of my childhood before it, or I, disappeared. A grandchild told me I was having a roots emergency, and I guess I was. I decided on a one-day visit. Enough, I thought, to cover a town only 6 blocks one way and 5 the other. And I planned not to visit people, only places. County Road 431 was never very lively. You see the cotton fields, but you need patience to get to the signs. The Banyan County one, and then the one that says Concordia Town Limits. After a church and a graveyard turn up, you are almost immediately on First Street. First Street seemed little changed from what I remembered. Though no longer cobblestoned, it is still only 3 blocks in length, stores on both sides. I went quickly to our old store, which had been in a center block, the number one location in that day's merchant speak. You used to be able to spot our store by the gold letters on the plate glass windows. Bronson's low-priced store. My father had splurged on those letters. For customer morale, he said, so customers would not feel that low-priced meant cheap. Our store is now Swain's Electronics, one of the few stores on the street that still sells things. Most of the properties that are occupied offer services. Some persevere from my day. The First National Bank, for example, seems as in charge as ever, its brass plaque gleaming, perhaps for the ages. At the end of the street, the train depot is still operating, if minimally. And across the railroad tracks, the church steeple rises into the air, though the church may no longer be New Bethel Baptist. Bronson's low-priced store was Concordia's Jew store. There had been none until my family got there, and in those days, it was the custom for every small southern town to have one. A Jew store, and that is what people called it, was a modest establishment selling soft goods, clothing and domestics, bedding, towels, yard goods, to the poorer people of the town, the farmers, the sharecroppers, the blacks, the factory workers. We were the only Jews among Concordia's inhabitants, of which, when my family arrived in 1920, there were 5,318, counting whites and Negroes. For us, Concordia actually began at the house of Miss Brookie Simmons. As I pulled my rental car up to it and sat looking, it seemed much as it had when I had last seen it. And I have no doubt, much as it had been when Aaron and Reba Bronson and family had pulled up to it themselves on their arrival in Concordia. Though I was not there on that first day, it doesn't really matter. The story of it, and the events leading up to and following it, have been so often recalled and relived in my family. They have long seemed as much my experiences as the things I remember as having happened to me. My mother and father are with us no longer for the nostalgia sessions that so engrossed us. But Miriam and Joey are still around. Miriam and Joey live up north. I in the south, though among a mixed population of southerners and northerners. Although Miriam has been living up north for many years, her southern accent is as strong as ever, if not stronger. Joey, Joe now to most people, but Joey as ever to Miriam and me, lost his a long time ago. Mine is still there, more there at certain times than at others. When Southerners are present, my speech is dense with y'alls and mercies, and much less so when they're not. Joey and Miriam and I get together as often as possible, and when we do, out come the stories, along with the snapshots and the newspaper clippings and the old store newspaper ads. Like Banyan County and Concordia, most names are not real ones, but what happened and why are pretty much the truth. Or, as my father would say, close enough so nobody argues about it. Chapter 1. The Destination. My mother always said she'd felt something of a letdown when she first saw the sign reading Concordia Town Limits. They had been riding for 3 days along rutted dirt roads north and west of Nashville. Somehow, she had come to believe that when they got to the town that my father had chosen for their new home, their destination, he said, there would be something remarkable about it, something that would set it apart from the other small Tennessee communities through which they had been traveling. But here they were, at the outskirts, as my father called it all his life, and what she saw were only more cotton fields, yet another wooden church with a cross on top, one more cemetery. So what should she have expected, she asked herself. An elevated train? Fancy gates? My mother wasn't exactly overjoyed at being there. Truly, ever since they had left New York City, her mood had been like a thing on her chest, as she used to say. 2 years and 3 months before, the family had ridden the train south to Nashville, where at least there lived other Jewish families, where there was a shul or synagogue, and the prospect of a glass of tea in the afternoons with the rabbi's wife. Now they were about to enter a small town in Banyan County, West Tennessee, 50 miles southwest of Paducah, Kentucky, wherever that was. They were going to try to open a store in a place where they would be the only Jews in town. These feelings of my mother's were very unlike those of my father. Indeed, in disposition, the two of them were very different. She was the one who looked back, fretted, viewed with alarm, often brooded. He lived for the future, crossed bridges when he came to them and not before, hoped always for the best. In looks, except that they were both small in stature, they were opposites as well. My father's appearance was bright and light, his straight hair blondish, his eyes famously blue, his smile quickly there. My mother was dark-haired and dark-eyed, and her smile came less readily. As they rode toward town, true to form, my father was ebullient, my mother apprehensive. "Oy, what were they doing here?" she was asking herself. Herself and her husband and her two children, here among these, as my father called them, country Tennesseans. From what she had seen of them along the road, she had already declared them a curious people. Were they not strange, these women who charged out of their houses, in bonnets stiff like iron, to sweep with brooms their dirt yards? Who ever heard? And oy, the church spires! As she looked now toward the town, she counted 6, or maybe 7. In such a small town, so many churches? From what she had heard, in the South, prayers went to God and to, Jesus. So why not just one big praying place, come one, come all? The deep gloom all at once upon her. She did what she always did when this happened. Put her head in her hands and moved it back and forth, as if tolling it. Like a bell my head was in those days, was the way she used to describe it. As the oft-repeated tale went, when, on July 16th, 1920, the Bronsons reached the edge of town, there was in the sky a heavy black cloud outlined in cold blue. Within a few minutes, the rain began falling. My father pulled the wagon into the graveyard, and my mother joined Joey and Miriam under the tarpaulin, which already sheltered the family's few possessions. My father stayed out in the now hammering rain and stared at the tombstones. On one, a poem started, "So sinks the sun after a gentle day." And he thought it was nice that somebody's day had been gentle, his own not having been gentle by anybody's call. My father had wanted to go by train. Concordia was a county seat, and therefore the train stopped there. But trains meant fares and freight charges, and with the debt to my grandfather for their trip to Nashville still outstanding, my mother, for whom a debt was, as she put it, like a growth, argued otherwise. "No," she said, "they should think of a penny saved, a penny to pay back with, and should therefore go by wagon." As if it were a matter of choosing the L over the streetcar to get to 125th Street, my father said. As the thunder retreated, my father heard its rumble as threats to return if he didn't do right. "Understood," he said to himself. "But right about what?" Out of his choices, of which he had many, he picked the most imminent, a place to stay. The wagon one more night was not an option. But where to look? And where was his mazel, his good luck, which should be turning up right about now to point the way? Suddenly, not from the heavens, but from the elm tree, plummeted 2 boys. As they stood staring at my father, they seemed, to him, the color and texture of the rain itself. Atop pale hair sat ancient Panama hats, the saturated brims undulating with each raindrop. Pants, perhaps once blue, were streaky white. White shirts, confined by suspenders, were soppy, the long sleeves, buttoned at the wrists, plastered to arms. Feet were bare. These were the Medlin brothers, T and Irv. As they announced their names, T, the older one, and the one who spoke, Irv, 6, only gazed, told my father he had been christened TJ, but was called T for short. As if, my father always said, 2 letters were too much of a mouthful. T was near to 9, although my father described him as one of those country boys who might be near to 9, but were more like near to 30. They were the sons of a cotton farmer and lived over yonder, T said, pointing to a peeling farmhouse. T was puzzled by my father's presence. "You be the new Jew peddler?" he asked him. "Jew, yes. Peddler, no," my father answered him. It was clear the boy had never before seen a Jew who wasn't a peddler. "Where you bound, then?" As we got to know T through the years, we all were aware of his habit of flicking his eyes up when he was doubtful. And he did that now. "And what you got in mind?" When told that my father was bound for Concordia and had in mind opening a store there, the boy seemed even more confounded. Though we all liked to do people, I always thought my father had a true gift for mimicry. And what T said now, according to how my father told it, was, "Danged if I ever heard tell of a Jew storekeeper afore. And law, in Concordia?" As the rest of the Bronson family emerged from the tarpaulin, T looked them over, commented in an aside to my father, "I see you ain't just the one Jew," and asked if they needed a place to stay. He had something in mind, the home of his cousin, Brookie Simmons, the one in Concordia who took strangers in, the one who, according to T, loved company like a darky on Sunday afternoon. My father had one question, the itchy how much. All the money he had in the world was in his inside coat pocket, and it was a slight amount indeed. "She charge much?" he asked T, not comfortable with the question, but having to ask it anyway. It was plainly T's view that everybody in the world, except my father, knew that Brookie Simmons was the daughter and heir of Coca-Cola Simmons, the bottling plant magnate and the town's wealthiest man, and as such, she would be little interested in such matters. "You don't know nothing if you think she's in it for the money," he said to my father. My father had no alternative but to chance it. He asked the boy, "So, you're ready to go, Mr. T?" "Yes, sir." T climbed into the back of the wagon, and Irv followed. My mother reseated herself on the perch. My father flicked the horse lightly, called out, "Vayo, vayo, giddy up, let's go, you willy, you," and the wagon was back on the road. Now that they were set for the night, my father felt that he was not mucking around in the yellow mud, which after the rain the road had once again become, but that he was gliding along a ribbon of gold silk. As they neared Concordia, T leaned over from the back to give my father directions. "Left as soon as you hit the cobblestones, Mr. Jew." The words flew out of her mouth, my mother said later, like a bird from an open cage. "Mr. Bronson, little boy." "Yes, ma'am," the boy answered her. The house of Miss Brookie Simmons was on 3rd Street, 2 blocks from 1st. It was a little different from the neighboring 2-story white frame houses, in that it seemed wide rather than tall, with a roof only slightly pitched. Perched on the roof was a little rectangular construction, an attic that had ignored symmetry and simply shot itself off to one side. What the house looked most like was a shallow-tiered, wide-iced, sat-on cake. As the wagon pulled up, everybody except my mother jumped off and started up the concrete walk. After the rain, the sun had come out full, and steam was rising from my father's damp wool coat. Also, Joey needed a haircut, and his black curls hung over his forehead like a bunch of Concord grapes. And Miriam was in a dress wrinkled as if it had been slept in. Well, my mother reminded herself as she sat alone in the wagon, it had been slept in. And she thought, "Oy, what if my father came back insulted? For the way they all looked. For being in a wagon. For being Jewish." She gave a long look to the house. It was a house in need of paint, sitting on pilings of cracked, often absent bricks. The steps were scuffed, the lattice under the house broken, the porch floor full of warps and waves. This was the house of the daughter of the richest man in town? Miss Brookie Simmons was out the door before the entourage even got to the steps. Out she came, short and round, a white cotton shirtwaist above, a long navy blue skirt below. Gold-rimmed glasses glinted as she moved, and salt-and-pepper gray hair, cut Buster Brown style, with straight-as-pins bangs, swung around. Plump she might have been, but according to my father, she was a fast mover. In one quick circuit she had hugged T, shaken my father's hand, run her fingers through Joey's curls, and twisted Miriam's earlobe. Irv's cheek was pinched and a peck planted. The lady seemed as pleased as a hen coming upon unexpected feed. As she went whirling around, she was saying, "Delighted," over and over, which to my father sounded hopeful. She finally made it plain and said to him, "You can have two rooms, and you can decide for yourselves who goes in which." My father couldn't decide on the spot who was going in which, but he liked this lady. "How could you not like her?" he used to say. "A lady so busy with such a nice hello." She bounded down the steps, and everybody followed. My mother watched her coming to the wagon. Brookie. What kind of name was that? The names she missed were more like Molka, Gittel, Moisha, which at this moment she feared she might never hear again. When the lady got to the wagon, she laid down a barrage of words. To my mother, such gibberish, she could only remain mute in the face of it. The lady finally reached up and tugged at my mother's arm, and in another moment, everybody was going up the walk, Miss Simmons in the lead, a strong flow of chatter in her wake. Joey and Miriam were jumping about, and my father was talking, laughing, being happy. My mother trailed behind. She felt, as she often said, like a shoe run over by many streetcars. Inside, the house seemed deep and dark. My mother at once thought she smelled the mustiness she had been advised to expect in Gentile houses. Hadn't she heard about a cleaning compound made of pig fat? Miss Simmons led them to two upstairs bedrooms, furnished identically. My mother's first bit of cheer came from hearing there was a bathroom down the hall. She had worried that, in this country town, there would be only outhouses, and she had been remembering them as they had been in the old country. Tiny huts in the backyard, to which you dashed on hot nights, frigid nights, any kind of nights, for things the house pot wouldn't do for. After a glance into both bedrooms, my mother plunked down on the double bed in one of them, and there she sat. Miriam was already twirling around, looking, touching. The curtains held her. The bedroom curtains of her memory had been thin and straight, uninterrupted by fold or flounce, and very unlike these great, white, billowy things, with ruffled edges swelling above their tie-backs. My father and Joey came in with the trunk, my father dragging from the front, Joey pushing from behind. My father figured my mother needed encouragement. "There ain't nothing to worry about," he told her. "We're doing okay." How could they be doing okay, my mother wondered. Everything was in such a tumult, a mishmash. She didn't even know how much they were being charged. And when she asked my father, he said he didn't ask and didn't know. And about being Jewish, had my father told the lady? Again, no. "You want the first thing out of my mouth should be, 'Hello, shake hands with a Jew?'" my father asked my mother. If the boys didn't tell her, and so far they hadn't, he wasn't going to say anything to anybody until they were safely settled. My father went outside to thank the boys. They were on the walk, already leaving. "Say," he asked them, "ain't it written somewheres that a little child shall lead them?" "Yes, sir," T answered. Isaiah 11:6. In the bedroom, Miss Simmons was trying to get my mother to come into the dining room. Her words were slow and carefully wrought, as if in this way to ensure comprehension. She said somebody named Lizzie Maud was fixing them something to eat. There was a mention of fried chicken and potato salad. Potato salad? That jumbled up stuff with all the mayonnaise? In the end, my mother didn't go down to the dining room. She pulled back what Miss Simmons had called the counterpane, and had pronounced counterpin, lay down, and went to sleep. If my mother had gone, she would have been convinced at last that she was in the house of someone with money. The dining room could be said to actually glow with riches. Mahogany gleamed, silver glinted, crystal sparkled. When my father came in with Joey and Miriam, he always told us, he gave a look to the already set table, to the silver pitcher in the middle, to the stemmed silver goblets, and to himself said, "Oi, oi, could the Poretsim, the Russian landowners, do better?" After a moment, the door between the dining room and the kitchen swung open, and a tall, softly contoured Negro woman came through. In one hand, she bore a silver platter of chicken, and in the other, a crystal bowl of something neither Miriam nor Joey had ever seen before. It was, of course, the potato salad. Miss Simmons introduced them to each other. She was Lizzie Maud. They were the Bronsons. Lizzie Maud said, "How do?" And my father said, "Likewise." Miriam and Joey, having never before been in such intimacy with a Negro, stared at Lizzie Maud. The woman was dark, the very color of the room's rich woods. Above full features, kinky black hair was pulled into tiny clusters, each tied with a ragged snippet of white cloth. On her feet were broken-down men's shoes that had metamorphosed into slip-ons. A muslin apron that, no doubt, countless washings had turned into filmy gauze, covered her dress. On the apron was a circle of words, which Joey, not yet in school and with the words barely visible, struggled to read. He finally made out, "Rambling Rose Flower, Pride of the South." Lizzie Maud turned back to the door, as if she had forgotten something. When she pushed back through, she had a silver basket of hot biscuits, loosely covered with a napkin. "Be a lots of shufflin' of the dishes," she said matter-of-factly. Into the silver goblets, Miss Simmons poured tea from the pitcher. When the tea came out, so did pieces of ice. Joey and Miriam have remembered staring. "Ice? In tea?" Miss Simmons put the pitcher down, and all at once the word Jewish was in the air. "Have I got that right?" she asked my father. "Aren't you folks Jews?"
It was out.
My father managed a nod. The lady said she thought so, had known it almost at once. According to how Miriam has always told it, Miss Brookie Simmons said, "I confess I had an inkling when I saw those ravishing black curls on the little boy and glimpsed a certain look here and there. And I thought, unless my brains have turned to rhubarb after all my years in this town, these people are Jews." We always expected a quote from Miss Brookie Simmons to be requoted, and in Miss Brookie Simmons's distinctive style, by Miriam. At doing Miss Brookie Simmons, Miriam was matchless. What finally had convinced her, Miss Simmons was saying, were the accents. Accents? She heard accents? And she saw certain looks? My father was nonplussed. Did my mother and the New York relatives have it wrong when they said he talked just like a Yankee? And didn't everybody say that, with his light coloring, he didn't look Jewish? He didn't fidget over it. The lady was taking the Jewish thing okay, and that's what was important. She was not only taking it, she was charging ahead. Now she was wondering if my mother hadn't joined them because she was kosher. "If she's kosher, I reckon she wouldn't touch chicken fried in bacon grease with a 10-foot pole, she said to my father. How could this country lady know so much about Jewish curls and accents and certain looks and kosher? But so easy was my father feeling, he chose not to ask. Joey and Miriam were eating. My mother was resting. There was a roof over their heads. The lady didn't seem to mind that they were Jewish. He told her not to worry, that my mother had a rule to see her through, and very important, one that carried the imprimatur of the rabbi's wife.
it was she who had given the word that, in a
sample complete. Ready to continue?